Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times, our 1980s podcast series that we did. We have obviously put time aside to talk about Bradford. We've talked about Heysel, and we've put together a trio of podcasts on Hillsborough. 35 years, the anniversary. It seems bewildering, certainly to me, who still feels the same age in many ways that I was back then when I took that day to Sheffield. We've already spoken to the wonderful Dr. Anna and Peter Scarfe, and our third and final guest is Andrew Knott, the man behind the Anfield Mosaics for the last 20, 25 years, I'd say now. I've known Andy for the best part of 30 years, and this is part of the complexity of Hillsborough. You know, those of us who were there and experienced it, I think for a lot of people, you didn't even have to be there. You know, if you watched it unfold on television or you knew people who were there, it affected, you know, so many people beyond those that were on Leppings Lane, that were in Hillsborough that day and beyond. You know, the ramifications still go on to this day. And the thing about me and Andy is that we've been best mates for years, each other's best man. We've been here, there and everywhere, Istanbul, Athens, Madrid, Paris, countless mad away trips that we've done over the years. But the complexity of the Hillsborough disaster is that even for people like me and Andy, I don't think we've ever really sat down and talked about Hillsborough before and our experiences.
We haven't. We knew we were both there.
Yeah, but exactly. You know, we both know we were there. You know, this was 5 or 6 years before we kind of crossed each other's paths, I think. Mid-90s that we've known each other. But we've never spoken about it. And we're not unique in that. There's so many people out there who know of each other's past, you know, with respects to this, but just don't talk about it. Andy, thanks for joining us.
No problem at all. It's great to be here.
Three simple questions, but the answers, you know, I'm sure won't be as simple as that. Just let us know who you were on the morning of April the 15th, 1989.
I was a 19-year-old, well, 20-year-old young lad from St. Helens, living in Cardiff at university, mad red, going everywhere, to the point where I was skipping college, skipping school. If we had an away trip midweek in a cup game, I had a migraine or I was going to the dentist. Everything was football. I used to drive home from Cardiff every week from uni, drive home on the Friday, go to match on the Saturday, drive back down on the Sunday. So basically, everything I did at that time was around going to the match. I used to go with my two brothers and one of my brothers' wives. The four of us, as I say, used to go everywhere. And obviously, up until that day, gone the match, everything had been fine. Used to go and have a laugh. Even on the way to the game, we were having a laugh because I was living in Cardiff. They were saying, oh, as we were going over the pass and we were going through fields of sheep, they were all saying, oh, sheep, Shaggy, you're from Cardiff now. You should be up over there. And we were having a laugh about it. But yeah, everything, I was just football mad. And as I say, driving 200 miles a week from Cardiff just to go to game, whether it's home or away, I'd drive from Cardiff, come home, and then one weekend, drove home from Cardiff on the Friday night, went out with my mates, got up at 5:30, drove to Southampton, came back from Southampton, went out with my mates, got up on the Sunday, drove back to Cardiff on the Sunday night. So I'd done like 1,000 miles, basically just so I could go to game. So that was me at the time.
It's something that we've continued down the years as well, many, many times over. So it's all familiar territory for both of us there. Going into that day, you know, Liverpool are on a magnificent run. Everything's, you know, running smoothly. The sun's shining. You know, difficulties in the first start of the season, but we're reigning Arsenal in. We've reached another FA Cup semi-final. You know, it's been a harder job to get to this point, but here we are. You know, feelings about going towards the ground and into the game.
as with any semi-final. I mean, I used to prefer semi-final days to cup final days sometimes, because at the end of the day, if you didn't get through that semi, you weren't going to the final, so you had to take that as important as the final, because, as you say, that year we should have won the treble, we should have won the League Cup, we should have won the FA, well, we did win the FA Cup, and we should have won the league. Obviously, that didn't transpire to be the case, but yeah, I mean, at that time, we were going to match, and it wasn't a case of were we going to win, it was a case of by how many. And in a way, we were probably spoiled at the time, because we did have such an amazing team. The manager was Liverpool through and through. So yeah, we were at a point in our life where, I say, we were going to game by how many we were going to win, not if we were going to win. And it sounds a bit big-headed to say that, but that was the case, I suppose, in a way. Man United fans used to think that when they were under Ferguson. But we were going the game, and we were pretty adamant we were going to win no matter who we were playing.
The afternoon of the 15th of April, 1989, never going to be easy to go into. But you know, this is an open floor for you to say, you know, whatever you want to say about your experiences of the afternoon.
Right. Well, we arrived early as usual. The one thing we did notice that was unusual, compared to the year before especially, was the fact that as we were coming down off the pass, there was queues and queues of coaches, and we were like, oh, why have they stopped the other coach? We thought they must be taking them in all at the same time. But then as you're going past, you can see they've got everybody off the buses. And you think that's a bit odd anyway. So we've gone, we parked where we always used to park, which was, if you imagine you're walking down to the ground and you go down the pass, before you get to the bottom where the actual ground is, we used to park in the terraced houses on the right. As you come down, I think there was a pub on the left a bit further up. Part there, as always, we went down the ground, we had a laugh, got something to eat. And we always used to try and get in the ground quite early, because we always used to try and stand in away games where we used to stand on the cop, so we had a similar view. So if you imagine the old standing cop, we were just in front to the right of the big column on the right as you're looking from the pitch. So we would always try and get in a similar position. So we were in pen four. So we got in, pen four, similar view to what we would normally have. Everything was happy. A gorgeous day, beautiful day. And just out of pure, I don't know whether somebody was looking over us that day. My brother Mark, I don't know if it's because it was so nice, he said, I wonder what the view is like from that bit in the corner. Do you know the uncovered bit at the top to the left of where we were stood? There was an uncovered like quadrant. So he said, oh, I'm going to go and have a look, see what the view is like from up there. So we stayed where we were. He wandered off. Next thing, come down. He said, it's a cracking view up there. See everything. And we moved. And we would never have done that, because every other time we'd been to Hillsborough in the past, we'd always stood in the same place. Why he said it that day, I'll never know. Somebody must have been looking over us that day, because at the time, I wasn't a little fella. I was quite stocky. Our Mark and Debbie were both big. And we moved, and I don't know why to this day we moved. So we were up there, and obviously as things transpired, we were looking down. You could see it was literally filling up and filling up and filling up. And our Mark said, oh, I'm glad we moved. He said, look at how chocker it is down there now. Anyway, obviously it's filling up, game kicks off, everybody's buzzing, especially when they hit the bar. There must have been another surge. And then obviously you could pretty much tell something had gone drastically wrong. Obviously, the people trying to get out, and like you got people, the police pushing them back in. The game stopped. And after about 10 minutes, they put an announcement for people who medically trained to go down and help. So our Debbie was a trained nurse. So I said, well, I'll come with you. So if we get split up, at least you're not on your own. There's two of us to get back to the car. So we made our way back down from the quadrant in the corner. And as we walked, gone round the back of the Leppins Lane, our Debbie turned round to me and went, fucking hell, Andrew, he's dead. I'd never seen a dead body in my life. I'd never been to a funeral. I'd never seen any of my ancestors or anything like that die. She said, he's dead. And then she went, so's he. And like that, like, because the adrenaline's going and we just wanted to get down and help, I sort of like blanked it out in a way. So we've gone down, we've walked, gone through the tunnel into the terraces. climbed out onto the pitch where they put the barriers down. She was giving people mouth-to-mouth, and while she was doing that, I was carrying people off on the hoardings, on the advertising hoardings. So did a couple of runs of that, and then I got to the far end where they were taking, where the ambulances couldn't get on. And as I've took somebody off on a board, I turned around, there was a police woman trying to carry a dead body on her own, and I've thought, do you want a hand? So just instinct, I don't know why it is, just instinct. So I've helped her, and she said, oh, we're going in this gym. So we went in the gym, which was obviously the temporary morgue at the time. And I don't know, when people watch the Jimmy McGovern documentary, I can watch that program right up until where they go into that gym, where they have the trampolines and the four trampolines in a square with the table in the middle. As soon as I see that, my head goes, because that was my first view when I walked into that gym. So anyway, I took the body and just looked around me, and you could see the bodies laid out, covered up in white sheets, and they were doing them in rows of 10. So I knew that there was 44 dead bodies in that gym, plus what the people who were coming in after us. Anyway, as we were carrying her in, you had people above who were obviously having a slash on the bit above, and it was dripping down. That comes in a bit later on the days afterwards. So I'd seen this, my head went. I got to a point where I'm going to have to go back and find Debbie. I don't know if I can take any more of this. So I've gone back, found Debbie. She'd resuscitated four people on the pitch. Two she'd brought back to life and two had died on her. So all of a sudden she says to me, shit, Andrew, the car keys are in my jacket and I've covered up a body with my jacket. So she went back to one of these bodies, got the car keys out, and she said to me, she said, oh, there's about 20 people dead here. I said, Deb, I can tell you now, there's at least 44, I said, because I've just seen the bodies laid out in that gym. That isn't the end of it, I said, because people were still coming in after I'd come out of that gym. So anyway, at that time, it was pretty much clear, because this must have been 45 minutes, an hour after the game had stopped. So she said, well, we're going to have to go and find the other two. So I can't even remember from when I went back to, I can't remember coming out the ground and getting back to the car. I can't remember any of it. The only thing I can remember is obviously because this had happened, we were trying to get to a phone. This is a day when we didn't have mobile phones. There was a queue 100 yards for the phone box. There was people knocking on people's houses asking, can they use the phone? And we ended up ringing home from a laundrette, which, so other than going in that laundrette, I can't really remember anything else apart from setting off back. When we set off back, we had a lad in the car. We give a lift back because he'd gone with his mate. He couldn't find his mate anywhere. So he said, well, we'll give you a lift back. And he lived actually just round the corner from Goodison. So we took him back, dropped him off. And I've never seen the fella since. But we know for a fact that he was worried about his friend because he had been in the Leppins Lane. And obviously, I was just numb coming back. All I can remember really the journey back was Radio City playing the Bangles' Eternal Flame pretty much all the way back. It seemed to be on repeat. In my head, it's as if it was on repeat all the way home. So obviously we got back that night. Can't remember much of that evening because, as I say, my head had gone. I just got in. I remember going around seeing my girlfriend at the time. As you said, I said, not going outside, I just want to stay in. She said, yeah, I understand that. So the day after, I was due to go back down to Cardiff. I was put a brave face on, oh, I'm fine. But then the service that they had at the Anglican the day after came on the telly. Anyway, my head went, so I just went and locked myself in my bedroom. There was no way I'd be able to drive back to Cardiff. I said, I'll go back in the morning. So tried to sleep, didn't sleep much. Set off about half 9 in the morning to go back to Cardiff. Obviously, I was alone with my own thoughts, thinking, not just thinking about what I'd seen, but the other, and I don't know how many people must say this, but my overwhelming feeling after that was guilt that I'd come home, because we'd stood there. If we had stayed where we were stood, I'm pretty convinced I wouldn't be here talking to you now. Because, as I say, we would have been right in the middle of Pen 4, and we would have just got pushed forward, pushed forward, pushed forward. And say, I wasn't the 6 foot four lad I was then, or what I am now, because I only started growing late. So I don't think I would have got out, to be honest with you. So my feeling since that day has been guilt that I come home and others didn't. And people say, oh, well, you shouldn't feel that, you shouldn't feel that. I said, but that's, you can't control how you feel. But that is my main feeling after that. So I'm driving down to Cardiff, say within my own thoughts. I said, I'm not going on the motorway, I'll go the A road, so it's quiet, I can pull over. And I remember on Radio 1, Simon Bates, our tune. And he said, right, with our tune, there's only one song we can actually play today. And he played You'll Never Walk Alone. So again, my head went. So I pulled over, had a minute, composed myself, just stopped for like half an hour, and then set off back to Cardiff. So I went, rather than going back to the house, I went straight into college. Now, Derek, who was our graphics tutor at the time, big West Ham fan, proper East End boy, I've gone into college, and like all the lads who I shared a house with or was on the course with have been ringing my mum, is he okay, is he okay, is he okay? She said, yeah, he's fine. Anyway, I've walked into college and Derek, the graphics tutor, said, Notty, what the fucking hell are you doing here? I said, Derek, I said, I had to get away to try and compose myself. I said, because if I sit back in Liverpool, it's going to be in my face all the time and I don't know if I'll be able to cope with that. I said, so I'm better in a way being a bit detached away from being here. But then obviously you get the newspaper reports that were in the Sun about people peeing on the coppers. As I alluded to before, there was people in the stand having a wee and it was dripping through the stands. Now, is that what they mean about people peeing on the police? If it is, then it's a pretty feeble way of trying to go down the Tory line of a cover-up and blaming the fans. The bit about pickpocketing from the dead, I know for a fact that has haunted our Debbie since that day, because she covered somebody up as she tried to resuscitate and her car keys were in her jacket. Has somebody seen her getting her car keys out the jacket and thought she's pickpocketing off a dead person? And these are things that people who say, oh, about the Sun, when they hear things like that, surely they've got to think about the way it was reported, and instead of just coming out with these ridiculous unfounded lies, they've not even thought about what it is. But no Liverpool fan on that day intentionally peed on a copper, and no Liverpool fan that day intentionally robbed from the dead. But as I say, I know for a fact that that has haunted our Debbie, and it haunts me the fact that why should she feel like that? Because she saved two people. Granted, she couldn't resuscitate two others, but she saved two people that day. And then obviously all the pictures come out in the paper of the people who died. And to this day, I couldn't tell you who that person was I carried into that gym. Because I see the pictures, even like every year when they have the anniversary, I'll look at it and I cannot tell you who that person was. I'd love to be able to, so I could go to the family and say, listen, I did my bit, but that was okay. It didn't happen that way because it was all because of the reporting of it and the way it was transpired after, and even for the up until the years until the last inquest where they said we weren't to blame. People still believe that, and when you hear like the tragedy chanted now, it's just if that could quite easily have been Everton, Man United, or any of the Northwest clubs, because they would have been in that semi-final playing that game and would have had that end and would have had the same thing because they were all well-supported clubs and they would have all had the issues of trying to get down to the ground, get in, and then obviously everything that's transpired since then that's come out in the inquest and what have you. But my other lasting memory as well is on the Friday, I drove back up from Cardiff because I wanted to go and lay some flowers at Anfield. Again, this is a little bit, I don't know what it is, whether it's fate or whatever, but I'd found out that one of our friends who we used to go Quadrant Park raving with, her dad and a cousin, David Hawley and Stephen O'Neill, had died. So obviously I was distraught for her. And when we got to Anfield and you went in like the Anfield Road and walk around, put your tickets and you could go on the cop, the first flowers I looked at, and that's his sudden red, because it was roughly near where we used to stand, was to David and Stephen. Now, I don't know if that's fate, pure coincidence, but why would the person who I knew would the first flowers be for her dad and her cousin? Again, I can't calculate that in my head. It's just one of them things that I still don't suppose I'll ever get my head around. It's like when our Mark asked, said, should we move? I'll never get my head around that, because we would never have moved. I said, we've been to Hillsborough since I probably went to Hillsborough the first time in 1982. We'd always stood in exactly the same place. But that day he said, shall we move? Now, either somebody was looking down on me or on us, or it's just one of them mad things that you'll never, ever even try and calculate in your head as to why we did that. So obviously that happened. And then again, my head went a bit in the fact that I thought, well, why, how has that happened? Is it just somebody reminding me or what have you? So I then basically, we went up to Celtic for the Memorial game. The four of us drove up. Don't remember a great deal of it, because I'd say for probably 2 months after that, I can't remember a great deal after that. I don't know if it's shock, grief. I don't know what it was, but I can't remember the final couple of months of my college because of it, because my head was gone. I mean, it got to the point where in college we had our own like little booths, and I'd decorated mine with like pictures of flowers at Anfield, and that was my little shrine to the people of Hillsborough. And then obviously it led up to the replay and then the final. Again, the final was just one of them things where I think if Everton had scored 6 that day, we would have scored 7, because there's no way that team were not going to win that cup for them people. And then obviously the last game of the season, the Arsenal game, I've only ever cried once at a football match, and it was that day, because I thought we're going to do this and they're going to do it for them fans, and obviously we didn't. But so that's the only time I've ever cried at a football match. Or should I say from disappointment. I've cried from happiness in Istanbul. But certainly from like sadness or disappointment, that's the only game I've ever cried at. I didn't cry the day at Hillsborough. In fact, I probably didn't cry until listening to our tune on the Monday. But as I say, I'd gone, I just stopped. The floodgates opened. And in a way, I felt a bit better after that. But then when I went into college, as I say, my mates in Cardiff and the tutors and everything, they were amazing. They sort of like kept me grounded. They kept their eye on me. But yeah, I'd say probably for 6 months, actually, I was probably a bit vacant to most people, to be honest. It was only because it was my second year of uni where I had to knuckle down. So I put me frustration, grief, whatever the feelings were, I put it into my uni so I could pass my course and then obviously go on to do what I've done since then. But I would say I'm certainly not the same person leading on to your final question that you're going to ask me.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a little bit, though. I mean, I wasn't intending to throw these in, but I'll throw these in as well. We were sat beside one another the 20th anniversary at Anfield, the infamous one where Andy Burnham was the keynote speaker. And Easter, it was. Easter 2009. So many people turned up that they had to open up the main stand and what's known as the Kenny Dalglish stand now. We've been so used to, you know, I don't know, a two-thirds populated cop for the annual trip for the memorial, which we'd always done. It doesn't go on now, but you know, we'd always meet up that day for it.
Well, from when we met, we went to everyone together, didn't we?
Everyone. Yeah. We didn't miss a one. But that 20th anniversary one that kick-started, you know, the ball rolling towards, I don't know, the exoneration, you know, of Liverpool supporters and the, you know, huge weight off the families. It still continues to this day, obviously, and there's always a door closed somewhere and, you know, slammed in faces. But things like the 20th anniversary, you know, stand out for me and so many others. The battle for justice, you know, standout incidents since then that I don't know, you can take some positivity from?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you say, we went to all them. In fact, I had my printing business and I used to print the service sheets. Originally, I was dealing with Phil Hammond. And then latterly, when Phil, his health took a turn, I was dealing with Trevor and latterly Anne and the others. And that was, I suppose, a way it's me doing a little something. It's like the mosaics. When we do the Hillsborough mosaic, there's always something in me that's my little thing of paying my respects, doing what we do. In a way, I wouldn't say I missed that, the memorial services, but they did help me. That one day in the year, that they did really help me. And now, obviously, we don't do them. So I just, especially since we moved over to Wales, I just had my own little minute, take myself off somewhere at 3 o'clock for 10 minutes or 20 minutes and just have my own little time, obviously, to remember. But yeah, I mean, we talk about like the standout moments and the fight since then. One of my biggest disappointments was Jack Straw. Now, you would have thought, being a Labour man from the Northwest, and he says, oh yeah, we're going to reopen it, but then nothing happened. And it took Burnham, who, let's face it, must have had balls of steel to stand up, and a politician standing up in front of all them people that day. And as you say, there was a lot of people at that ground that day. For him to stand up and say what he'd said, in a way, I don't think he had any option to, because he just got to the point where he looked at the emotion and had no way of other than to say, I will do what I can. And alongside that, Steve Rotherham. I mean, how much has he done for people over the years? Obviously, it become Murder City, deservedly Murder City because of what he did at that time. But I think the fact that he invited Andy Byrne to come down and see the emotion was probably one of the deciding factors in that as well. Other standout moments was obviously, for me, was when we did the Truth Mosaic against Arsenal, an FA Cup game, three sides of the ground. And we were told by Jed Poynton, you can't hold it up while the game's going. I said, okay, Jed, we won't. But we knew we were going to do. We knew we were going to do that for 6 minutes. Whether anybody tried to stop us or not, we were going to hold that mosaic up. In fact, you sent me the photographs of it because you were obviously in the main stand, you had a better view of it. There was no way that wasn't going to be held up for 6 minutes up until that point where people knew. And is it Henri has said since then? He said it's one of the roar after we put the mosaic down that day. It's probably one of the loudest things he's ever heard in the ground, which for me, yeah, it just shows the feelings, the emotions. And even now, as you say, with the doors getting shut in people's faces, there's still never really been justice. There's been exoneration, but there's never really been justice. And you can understand, because I have people say to me, oh, it's so many years now, why don't they just give up? They're not going to get nothing. Well, if you think that, you're messing with the wrong city, aren't you? Because we wouldn't give up. There's no way. I know, I've got to know personally, like Phil, Trevor. I mean, another point, I think, since then, I remember there was no memorial at Hillsborough for years. And we spoke to Rick Parry and we said, can we do a mosaic for the Sheffield Wednesday game? And the chairman at the time, Dave Richards, we'd done the mosaic. There was no aggression, no animosity. We did the mosaic, and after the game, he actually said, we've got to look at start doing something because of the way that was done. Now, obviously, then there was the boycott of Hillsborough until the memorial come. Now, I remember there was me, John Pearman from Red All Over the Land, Kathy Long, who was Liverpool's FSA representative, and Rick Parry went over to meet him at Hillsborough because we'd had this campaign about boycotting Hillsborough because through the fanzine. And we went over, and I remember at the time we'd bid him, we were sat in the boardroom saying, listen, it needs to happen, it needs to happen. There's no real respect from your club until you acknowledge what happened here that day. And as far as we're concerned, if you don't do that, we will not be coming to this ground. And I said, and all the fans who we know, we'll boycott it, we'll campaign. And on the day, I remember he actually took us out. We'd had the meeting, he took us down, we went down a tunnel, went out, and we actually stood in front of the Leppins Lane. Obviously, it was seats then. But the feeling I got that, even though it looked different, it certainly didn't feel different. And I say it was a little bit eerie, and obviously because the ground was empty. It's like when we've done mosaics in the past, you go to Anfield, it always feels a little bit different when the ground's empty. So I say we had the meeting, then we drove back, and John come back with me, and we hardly spoke all the way back, because of the fact that we'd been there, we'd stood there, and thankfully they listened, they got the memorial put up, although I still don't think it's in the best part of the ground where it could be. There could be something a little bit nearer to where we were, but again, things like that have happened since, where it's all about getting recognition for the victims, the survivors, and the families.
Absolutely, absolutely. Another thing I'll throw in, we were both caught up at the Stade de France as well. You know, another facet of this, another angle of it. Spoke a little bit about this to Peter Scarfe, mentioned it with Anne as well. That brought a lot back, certainly for me. I feel I've not been quite the same since Paris. You know, put a lot that had been put aside in the back of my mind over Hillsborough has never been put back since Paris.
When we come out of that subway and we went down the side of the police vans where it like funneled us in, we were next to each other, and like there was kids having panic attacks, crying, distraught. Women who were on their own, couples of girls who had gone as friends. And I remember me and you were like, we were trying, whoa, get back, trying to push people back. But it got to the point where it was impossible to do that, where you felt like no matter how much you push, you're not going to be able to move it, because it's just coming in and coming behind you, to the point where we got split up. We were there till we were about, I think it must have been about 10 yards from where the barriers were. And all of a sudden, I'd turn around, you weren't there. And I thought, where's he gone then? It was only when we got right near where I could see you, because I'd sort of like funneled out to the left a bit because there was a young girl having a panic attack. So I'd sort of like tried to get her out to the edge. But then other than that, I can't remember not being next to you, but because of the pressure that was coming, you couldn't control where you ended up. And again, it's hard to imagine that situation could happen again. And if it hadn't been for the quick thinking or the forcefulness of the Liverpool fan literally going over, picking the barriers up and moving them, I wouldn't like to say what could have happened that day. And it was only when we got to the top of the ramp where we'd obviously got back together and like, oh yeah, you're all right, I'm all right. And obviously we had to look round. But it just, as you say, it brings back so many memories, how easy that could have turned into a second Hillsborough. I don't think it would have been to the scale of what we witnessed at Hillsborough, but there certainly could have been fatalities that day if it hadn't been for the fact that they just let the barriers go. And again, that wasn't down to the police decision. That was the Liverpool fans went over and said, people are getting hurt here. And they basically moved the barriers so it cleared. But then to add insult to injury, you get to the turnstile and then they tear gas you. I mean, when people say to me, oh, what happened in Paris? I just say, look back and read Brian Reid's article. And they say, why is that? I said, because I was stood next to him in the queue. Where Brian was, that's where I was stood. So if anybody wants to know what happened, read that. And as I said, I couldn't see most of the first half. Yeah, and I was in half hour before the game actually finally kicked off, but I couldn't see. And when I met up with you after, somebody kicked a tear gas can and it had gone up in your face. And even when we were coming back the day after, every time I blinked, I could feel my eyes going. It was only probably when we got back in this country where my eyes started feeling a little bit, but that's probably because we'd had a bit of sleep. And but yeah, it was terrifying to think that it could have happened again. And I'm pretty sure that there's been other episodes over the years where the authorities, the policing, could quite easily have caused these kind of situations. But other than the quick thinking of the fans and people who know what it was like that day, thankfully it hasn't. It's never been to the point where that has happened. But yeah, you're right. Under that bridge, trying to get up to that ramp was horrendous.
It was. I think it was with Peter, and he put out the really good point is that with Paris, those of us who'd been, at Hillsborough, knew of Hillsborough as well, that previous experience was actually a help in making Paris, it helped in a way. Because I know from my perspective in Paris, there was no, the secret to getting through that, or the trick to getting through that was to stay calm. And yeah, a lot of the people
weren't.
A lot of the people that weren't calm were people of a younger generation. What was quite telling was that people who were, old enough to have experienced or know of Hillsborough seemed to be the ones that were taking a little bit of control, or what control that they could. I know that there was a lad next to me who was just absolutely in hysterics, and I had to shout at him basically to get your head together, because you're going to cause problems here. More than you're not going to. But yes.
Well, I think it's not just the fact that, it was like standing on a standing cop, queuing up to get into the ground when in the old days, it was pretty much, it was common practice for you to be six or seven deep with people behind you trying to get into the ground. But as you said, the younger generation, they've never witnessed it. They've never been in that situation where they can sense that danger. As you said, they just panic. And I said, the young girl who was next to me, who I saw like ushered out to the side, she was with her dad, but I don't think her dad had ever witnessed anything like that. So I just said to him, get her to the side so she can get breath. Tell her to breathe. Because if she doesn't, she's going to start hyperventilating, and she could cause herself more damage. So, but yeah, it was grim. It was grim that evening.
Absolutely. But yeah, final question. 35 years on, where are you now with the events and the repercussions and the knock-on effect of the Hillsborough disaster?
It'll never go away. Anybody who was there that day will never, ever, ever forget that day, whether you were stood on the Leppins Lane, whether you were lucky to move like we did, whether you were in the stands at the side, even if you're a Nottingham Forest fan looking at it from the other end. And at the time, they didn't know what was happening. They just thought, the Scousers are invading the pitch. But since everything's come out, they must think to themselves. My life has never been the same since. I'll say that now, definitely. In a way, you know me, I'm a very, very, very laid-back, chilled person. Not a lot rattles me. In fact, Carrie, my wife's only seen me lose my rag twice in 12 years. So I'm quite like that. But again, a lot of that could come down to the fact that maybe I think to myself, I'm lucky to be alive here. I can't be too serious. I've got to make the most of what you've got. I don't know if that's just the way I'm naturally grown, but I think a lot of that comes from the fact that I survived that day. And I didn't suffer an injury. I wasn't squashed, but I survived that day physically, mentally. I certainly know I didn't. I survived. I got out of it, but I would never be the same again. Even now, I work in a school in North Wales, so you got Blues, Manx, Liverpool fans, even got a Chelsea fan, which is a bit random. But I try and educate, because there was one the other week, we were just having a bit of banter about Liverpool Man U. And he turned around and he said, yeah, but at least we don't kill people at the ground and squash people and all this. And I just, my head went, never screamed or shouted. I said, listen, Dan, come here. Pulled him to one side. I said, listen, don't ever say anything like that to me ever again. I said, come here and let me educate you. I said, you're a Man U fan. I said, your dad or your granddad could have been at that game supporting Man United that day. I said, if you want to sit down with me for an hour, I'll tell you the story. And in the end, I told them the story I've just told exactly then to that day, because I had him, I was covering a lesson once and I had him, because there was no like proper cover work. I just sat down and said, listen, this is what it was like. And you know what? Since that day, he's been, we have a good laugh about the football now. He doesn't get like mardy about it. And then there was another kid, Ryan, who said something about the 97. Again, I just said to him, Ryan, come out the room. I need to have a speak to you. I mean, he's more of a Wrexham fan, but he says he's a Man U fan as well. But from that day, he has got a mutual respect now. There's a respect that he knows I've educated him on that day. And I'm not going to sit here and act all innocent. I remember I have been probably 13 or 14 at the height when the Munich Herders asked people to sing Munich 58. I was stupid enough to have a half Liverpool Celtic hat, and I'd wrote Munich 58 marker pen on it because I was a kid. I was stupid. Nobody had educated on it, but my brother was best friends with a lad called Neil Jusnip, who ended up being academy director at Everton. I think he's working with the Canadian national women's team now. But his dad, Jimmy Jusnip, was a scout for all the clubs in the Northwest. And Neil's walked in the house, seen this hat, walked down, thrown in the bin. I said, what have you done that? And he said, my dad's best mate was on that plane. And when you hear that and you personalise it, I was like, what do you mean? He said, Bobby Charlton is my dad's best mate. And he was on that plane. He said, if I ever see anything like that again, don't ever speak to me ever again. And once somebody personalises it, that, it's a similar thing to like the racism and everything else. You educate somebody on these kind of things, they'll understand it. But there's some people who don't want to be educated on it, and they'll still do the tragedy chanting, things like that. I say I'm not going to be a hypocrite and say when I was 12 or 13, stupid, and I used to go to Liverpool game, they'd sing me, oh yeah, yeah. So, but once you personalise it and you get that into your head, and you can explain to somebody what happens, how it happens, how it could have been somebody else, people then, they can relate to it in a different way. And as I say, at that time, that day when Neil walked in the house, my view completely changed because he personalised it. And when people do like the tragedy chanting that they do now, they don't want to understand what it was like. I mean, we could do this podcast to 20 million people in the world and they still wouldn't want to understand what it was like. However, us who were there, yourself, me, Mark, Debbie, Gary, we were there and we know what it was like. And again, it's changed me. Not, I mean, I wouldn't say it's changed me for the worst or for the better or in any way, but it changed me. Probably more so in the fact that I'd never seen a dead body before that day, and ended up seeing I know for a fact there was 44 in the gym, plus the ones that were on the back of the stand where we first saw. Everybody remembers the day they first see a dead body. Well, that day I saw too many in one day, and I wouldn't wish that up on anybody.
Absolutely, absolutely. Andy, thanks so much for doing this.
No problem.
Like I said at the start of this podcast, we've never spoken like this about that day. We both knew we were there, you know, and a lot of water's got under the bridge over the years and stuff that we've done in the name of following Liverpool, and you know, say some great stuff and some truly horrible stuff. But yeah, that was just brilliant, absolutely fantastic.
No problem. Thanks for having me. As I say, anything we can do to educate people on what happened that day and made them realise that it could have quite easily been, I say, any club in the North who got to that semi-final could have been in that situation that day, because he would have had that end of the ground.
It was. the mention of kind of like personalising things like this, you know, and that goes for any disaster sporting or otherwise. You know, that is absolutely what these three podcasts have been about. It's about, you know, looking past, you know, a number, looking past headlines and the, you know, the banner name of a disaster and putting personalised stories to. And you've added to that, you know, exactly what Peter did, exactly what Anne did for us as well. Yeah, but thanks so much for your time.
No problem.
All that leaves me to do is say thank you very much for listening. If you've listened to this one but not the other two, please do. Backtrack to Hazel and Bradford as well. There's a lot that we've done, and these had to be done. This has been another podcast from These Football Times. Please do join us again next time. Thank you and goodbye.